This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rastan, today we have the returns of, after a very long time, she's an actress, she's a producer, it's Farah Rani.
Hello, hello.
And we have also the return of, after far too long, he just wants to be described as simply a writer. Mm. He is Edin Koo.
Yeah, I've not been invited for a long time.
Okay. We don't have producer Ali today. It's producer Daryl. So we'll have to take it up with producer Ali when he's back. It's his fault, not me. Mm. So our three topics this week are: topic number one is civilization. Topic number two is Pontiana. Mm-hmm. And finally, topic number three, language. So topic number one, civilization. There are many words out there that we think we know, but when you actually start to look at them closely, they sort of fall apart before your eyes. And I think one of the biggest words is the word civilization. If we say that word, I'm sure images come to mind that would describe that phase in human evolution. Perhaps we live in a civilization right now. I don't know. Another word which perhaps is the opposite that we need to bear in mind is prehistory, prehistoric, before history. So, you know, cavemen, people just sort of fishing and anonymous lives, eons of time and leaving very few artifacts behind. So if there's a prehistory, there must be a moment when history began. And the traditional teaching is that history kind of began with the birth of civilizations in the Fertile Crescent, like Mesopotamia, in present-day Iraq. Then there's the Harappan civilization in the Indus Valley. In China, you have on the Yangtze River, etc. Then we start seeing things that we recognize as sort of somewhat modern. I'm going to guess that civilization would require agriculture, a structure to society with lords and peasants. And after that, I'm not really sure what civilization is.
It's organized living. It's collective living. And it's that moment upon which we suddenly got a sense of a history and began to record things down.
Yes, but then there are there are communities that existed before, say, Mesopotamia, who were also organized livers. Mm. It's just that archaeologists didn't find them or haven't found enough of them to make it look like, you know, the pyramids.
Yes, having been trained in archaeology myself.
Have you?
Yes.
Serious?
My master's in archaeology.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's basically, it's the widening of the discipline, actually, and it's been a quarrel that has happened in the field of archaeology for close to 30 years. For example, how do you deal with orality as a civilizing characteristic? Because it has not been regarded as an aspect of civilization. Mesopotamia is very often pointed at as the beginnings of civilization because of stone tablets.
Ah.
Yeah. So anything that came before that is kind of regarded, yes, they have a term for it, and it's called prehistoric, in the sense that a written awareness of history had not yet come about. It doesn't mean they're not civilized. It just means there is a different kind of consciousness about what a sense of civilization is. So much about a sense of memory. In fact, I was just teaching.
God, there's more. Isn't
there? Yes, there is. He has a master's in archaeology. Yeah, yeah.
I was falling back. I was discussing with my students the book Civilization by Kenneth Clark.
Yes.
And the TV series.
Yes.
How civilization is so much about shifts in power. Power centers, yeah?
Mm.
And how so much of civilization, according to Kenneth Clark, didn't take into account the Persians, didn't take into account Angkor, and civilization as we understood it really began with Greece.
Yes, yes, from the European perspective. Yeah. And also, well, speaking of Kenneth Clark, he actually famously said that with civilization, he had trouble. His famous TV show was called Civilization,
mm-hmm.
and he had trouble describing what civilization was, but he said that I know it when I see it.
Yes.
Because there's also another word which connects with civilizations, which is civilized. And we can't help but put the two words together.
Yeah. So when I hear civilization, I think white man saying, oh, look at this uncivilized people. And so why is it that the Europeans get to decide what's civilized and what isn't?
I would agree entirely. Because, I mean, the word civilized and civilization come from the French. Actually, civilized or civility happened before the word for civilization. So we kind of tend to put the two together, thinking that civilization must have civilized people. But the two words are actually separate. But when the British took hold of the notion of civilization, they traveled around the world and they found these places. And they liked to say that these were civilizations, which helped legitimize themselves or reinforce their own self-image as being a civilization, as opposed to just those barbarians out there. Mm. Running around with like sharpened mangoes, as it said in Blackadder once. it is very much a European construct. What about the Malay civilization?
Every civilization, that's why I said notion of civilization is so rooted in hegemony and power. So every civilization has its own concept of its own superiority.
Yeah.
Hence Chinese civilization and the Middle Kingdom, that the whole the world essentially is focused or centered around China, and everything beyond the Chinese borders is, well, barbarism, really. The Persians have that notion. The Indians have that notion. The Javanese have that notion. Nusantara is the outside world. It's quite strange that we've come to regard the Indo-Malayan archipelago as Nusantara, using essentially what is a derogatory term in Javanese to mean the outside world, as in the barbarian world, the outsiders. So every civilization has an inbuilt sense of its own superiority.
Well, then what about the opposite of that then? So if we look at Peninsula Malaysia, and I guess also the island of Borneo as well, that it's one of those sort of black holes in the civilization world. You have, Indian civilizations, mm-hmm. China, Java, you could even say Majapahit, etc.
Yeah.
But the peninsula has not had been able to call it, never used the word Malay civilization.
No, we have come to use the term Malay civilization in very recent times. Objectively, the term civilization has not been used, but people use the word Bujang Valley civilization these days, for example.
Yeah.
They don't use the Malacca civilization.
Malacca Empire. That's another word for civilization.
So terms are also being used very loosely.
Is Tamadun the same as civilization? Because I remember in the history books, it's Tamadun Melayu. That existed pre-Europe, it does exist, this idea that we had a civilization prior.
Yeah, and both those words then carry a certain judgmental weight to them, that civilization is a grand and good thing.
Yes. But we go back to language again, because civilization, is used in a very scholastic sense, meaning a certain kind of development in a society's evolution. Then it's used in a very loose sense, as in, a civilization that possesses all these characteristics of being civilized. So they are two very different, one is used more loosely and one is used more specifically. And very often we can't tell the difference between the two.
Well, we're going to move on though. One final question then. So therefore, we three of us right now, are we members of a civilization? Are we members of several different civilizations? Are we living in a civilization, or is that something that you only think about in looking back?
No, what really interests me is that point when you feel you need to uncivilize and decivilize. It happened with European modernism, for example. Mm. Freud was all about fighting this notion of civilization and giving acknowledgement or affirmation to your primordial self. I think so much of the work I do in Kelantan about, subconscious levels needing to appear and release, and notions of spirit and things like that. These are all forms of acknowledging the primordial.
I mean, that's the whole New Age movement as well.
Well, move on then to a person who is one of the most civilized people I know.
Thank you.
Farahani. Topic number two, Pontianna.
Yeah, so today it's been a year since the two women in Terengganu were publicly caned. And I'm putting this in inverted commas, attempting lesbianism. Mm.
For being in love.
And child marriage is still legal in Malaysia. And I have friends who are still fighting to get alimony for their kids in the Sharia courts. So today I want to talk to you about Pontianas. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, obviously a Pontiana is a woman who dies during childbirth. And she turns into this horrific feminine monster. And what she does is she lures men with her beauty. And then when the men get closer, then her fangs come out and she kills him.
By draining his blood.
By draining his blood, yes. And yeah, so it's a beautiful woman, and then you come close, and then she turns into an old hag and fangs and all that. And isn't that, do you think that's what men think marriage is?
yeah, the old 1970s kind of
Like you
way of telling it. Yeah. They were born in China.
And also, the only way to kill a Pontiana is to drive a nail through her throat.
Yeah, to her throat, yeah.
To her throat. And that's, you know, shutting a woman up. Like, I'm finding, because I watched this movie, which I will recommend later. So movies recently have shown these Pontianas as seeking revenge against men who have done them wrong.
That is their raison d'etre. That is what they do, isn't it?
No, but I think generally it's against men. But these, I think these movies recently have kind of focused it on like, oh, men who have done these women wrong. But the idea of this Pontianak has also been so villainized, this monstrosity, this feminine monstrosity. I don't know. Well, you know a lot more about
Well,
about
actually,
Pontianak,
you know, I live in... literally on the borders of the last jungle reserve in Kuala Lumpur.
Yes, so do I.
Persiaran Negeri Sembilan. And I face the jungle.
Yeah.
And I walk out every night. I tend to go out very late at night.
Yeah.
And I'm always hoping to see a Pontianak, and I never do. The other day I came close. I saw a white, what seemed a white apparition, and I was delighted. But it was some sheet la, that people were doing kind of landscaping or something.
Is it because really is it because you're a good man, Adin, that you haven't seen a Pontianak?
No, the Pontianak is completely, completely misunderstood. And it's, you know, for a long time, it was colored by this view of how we perceive horror.
Yeah.
Horror in films and things. And then, of course, there was an attempt to reclaim the Pontianak by feminism.
Yeah.
Western-influenced feminism. And the story of the Pontianak is actually very tragic and very poetic. And it's about a woman who's been wronged, of course, who comes back and seeks justice.
Yeah.
And she's also a woman who was dicabol, yeah? So the child, yeah, the child. Yeah, yeah. Well, raped, kind of. It's not very clear whether it was rape or, you know, it was a marital rape. Nobody really knows, but it was a kind of, it was against her will. And then, of course, the child dies and she comes back. And she's a very, very tragic figure, which I've never seen depicted seriously on screen or things.
Yeah.
You know, even the old stories of Pontianak Gua Musang and all that, you know, very, very kind of black and white. But she is a very, very, she's kind of like, you know, I think Dracula and stuff were based on characters this.
But is there?
But she's a wronged woman.
She's a wronged woman. Yeah. She's seeking justice.
She's seeking
the story of Pontianak is about justice and about women.
And about
So it's a sympathy. I mean, originally it would be earlier
very
on, it would be sympathetic.
Sympathetic.
But in the modern popular culture, she is an absolute demon.
Yeah. No, she kills men.
And the sympathetic quality is gone.
Well, I mean, not that I know of. I mean, aside from this movie that I watched, that I'll tell you about in a bit. But generally, the Pontianak is the scary figure men should watch out for.
And so many, I mean, somebody was telling me that all Malay ghost story, or superstitious apparitions are female.
They're female and they're very tragic. You know, there's a sense of pathos and the melancholic in Malay morality tales.
Yeah.
It's very sad because you never get what is your due. And so the sense of you know, existential despair is very, very much there in traditional Malay culture. And somehow it's not men or women, or it's just the whole world is made up that way. That somehow, you know, you're just never going to get justice. And that is life, right?
Is that a very Malay idea, do you think?
No, it's a very classic, very, very traditional idea. Very traditional idea that hell on earth basically is living, right? And it doesn't matter whether you're men or women.
Yeah.
And it has a lot to do about power as well.
Mm.
So, you know, so much power is located in men.
Yeah.
And it's not so much men, but it's the power that and you get this a lot in traditional Malay theatre because you're constantly subverting the powerful.
Yeah.
They may be men, they may be women, but when they have power, they behave in the same way.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, a long time ago, I did co-production with Japan. So we were looking at different mythologies, and we found a character who, I can't remember the character's name now, in Japanese folklore, who's so similar to the Pontianak.
Mm. Ah.
And if you go then across to Grimm's fairy tales, etc., and Puss in Boots and all that, the European ones, the demons there, a lot of women, but also nature, so that the forest was a thing to be feared, and the forest contained things that were just uncivilized. and so, I mean, one of the most evil characters, consistently evil characters in European tales, is the evil stepmother. But that's actually rooted in a sort of historical fact, in that so many women died in childbirth. And the children might live, but the woman would die, or there would be plagues, etc. The man would then remarry. And it was not in the interest of this new wife to look after the kids of the previous wife. So you had evil stepmothers.
Ah.
And in the fairy tales, they'd be shoving the kids into ovens and they'd be incredibly cruel. Mm. So there can often sometimes be a sort of like a historical story.
What's the symbolism of the banana tree? Do you know, Eden?
Yeah, banana trees are often used for death.
Oh. Well,
yeah, they're often used for death.
For death?
Yeah, for death. I mean,
as a symbol for death.
Yeah, for symbol of death. And a lot of the banana leaves, for example, are used, you know, to cover mayat and things in those days. So it has a very close relationship with
death.
Yeah, with death. But, you know, one of the very interesting things about these horror stories is the fact when you go back, when you look at them, you know, within the worldview they were encapsulated in. Emotions are not categorized, you know. So this is not something to be feared or something to be repelled. You have a whole gamut of emotions. There's fear, of course. Yeah. There is a certain degree of revulsion, but then there's sympathy. There is a pathos. There is a melancholy, all associated at once, right? Mm. So it becomes a very complete and total experience. We don't get that now. These days,
it's black and white.
Yeah, this is something to be feared.
Woman's
this
a
is
monster.
Exactly.
Man's a good. Gonna
exactly.
Okay. Well, we must move on. But finally, so you, on the other hand, Farah, you feel some sympathy for the...
Yes, no, absolutely. I feel like we need to take a lesson from the Pontiana.
Yeah.
And I don't mean kill men, and I love men, especially the men in this room. But we need to bear our proverbial fangs a little bit more.
Oh, okay. So we're back in a moment, though. And in a moment, we're going to be moving on to another big subject. Language.
It's a light day today.
Yeah. Language. We'll be here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Farah Rani, and Edin Koo. And now, topic number three, language, Edin.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about language, as I've been asked to comment on a very recent and quite fiery subject, which is the teaching of Jawi or Khat. Or Khat Jawi. And now nobody can tell the difference between the two. So let me clarify that. Jawi is a particular alphabet that was used to first write Malay. Khat is a stylized form of Jawi writing.
Calligraphy.
Calligraphy, that's right, precisely. Khat is calligraphy and it's present in every society that has used the Arabic language, Arabic script at one time for their language. So in Urdu, in Persian, you know, these can be both religious and secular in nature. Uh-huh. And there is now a real confusion about Khat Jawi and they're being used interchangeably. So, you know, I begin to think a lot about language and it's the way we talk about civilization. Civilization is just used to describe anything civilized or perceived to be civilized. And we have come to kind of forsake any sense of having a particular appreciation for a particular word, right? And we're very loose with language. And language is taught in the most appalling ways these days. And one of the reasons why I supported the teaching of Jawi very much in school.
Jawi or Khat?
In Jawi. Yeah, yeah. Jawi. You can't actually do Khat if you don't know Jawi, made me confused, yeah. Right? How can it be Khat Jawi when actually what you'd be stylizing is the Jawi alphabet? Yeah. Weird.
Yeah.
And now it's being used interchangeably, so callously. A lot of thought has gone into what language actually means to us these days and what its function is. Mm. How do we learn it? One of the reasons why I supported teaching of Jawi is because I think the teaching of language should be more expansive. You know, it should take into account the cultural and historical legacy of a particular language rather than just teach us communication skills. which has made us really kind of Neanderthals.
Well, you've expanded the syllabus to a child's workload by like tenfold. Surely one of the fears, one of the concerns with the Jawi stroke cut argument is that the script, it's an Arab script.
Yeah.
I'm trying to channel the people who are up in arms, and the fear is that this would be taught to non-Muslim Malay children, and it would be an extension of
the religion of people. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
You know, people are so afraid of their own shadows. Huh? It's really nonsense. It's identity politics taken.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. But you said earlier coding, but isn't coding a language as well?
Yeah, coding's a language, but you can learn coding. Why can't you learn Jawi, man? You know, have a sense of. You know, all knowledge is useless in the end. All knowledge is useless. And, you know,
but some things are more useless than others.
No, but Jawi is not one of them. It's very important to be rooted in. Otherwise, you're going to speak like Neanderthals now, which is what we're doing today.
But that Jawi,
we have an entire generation of people who can't speak English or can't speak Malay.
Yeah, but that's you're talking about the script and the language.
Yeah.
So Jawi has been superseded by the Romanized versions of the language. So you can learn the Romanized language and learn the language. And where do you come across Jawi? When I was at school, I learned Latin. Speaking of useless, I don't remember a damn word of it.
Latin is not useless.
Well,
it's not useless.
I learned it, and I can tell you it's useless.
Well, but you know the origins of words, right? It's easy for you to learn in different languages now that you know Latin. Or no?
No.
No, not at all. You know,
look, we are producing functional people.
Yeah.
People who function, you know? I don't understand what this idea of a certain kind of knowledge is useless. So we are producing, you know, there are entire fields of knowledge that are dying out. Because people do not see a utilitarian use for them.
I don't think the argument against, and if that's what we're talking about, if this is what our conversation is pros and cons of the teaching of Khat, I don't think the argument is about the utility so much. I haven't really heard people talk about that.
Because they don't know.
What don't they know?
They don't know what they're learning a language for.
Ah.
Okay. Well, you set this up as language, and you've said you've given it a lot of thought.
Yeah.
And your conclusions are.
That we are putting priorities towards very functional things. You go to school, you learn a language because it has market value. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what the hell that term market value is. you speak really. I'm amazed at how with younger people, the ability to speak is getting very, very restricted. You know, you can't pronounce properly. You don't learn any of those things. You don't recite poetry so that your diction is good. Mm. You don't articulate. And so you create people who speak like mummies in very bad horror films these days. And lots of parents think that that's perfectly fine.
You would like to teach language in a kind of very wide...
In a very expansive way.
Very expansive.
Yeah, the way we learned it. Yeah.
What do you think language is for, Eden?
Language is for poetry. And language is to express yourself. And it's not for short forms. Language can be quite meaningless sometimes. It just has to fall in proper cadence.
I think language also is to express yourself, to be understood, to understand others. But also it is important to be respected so that when the way that you communicate is not infantilized.
To express yourself more fully, this is how I feel and I can articulate that. Is that what you mean?
But it's also then in the eye of the audience, of the people whoever's listening to you.
Mm.
But I am against the idea of seeing utility in everything. I hate that. And I mean, recently, I think that I was away at the time, but I do believe that funding for arts education, etc., has been, you know, because it's not, there's no utility.
There's no use for it.
There's no use for it, which is insane. Because, you know,
the most useful thing, I think, to teach the arts.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a fear that, you know, your kids will go down the wrong road and become, I don't know, God, you know, like actors.
Fire Rennie. Sorry, Mom and Dad.
Another aspect of language, of course, is to pull you into complexity.
Mm.
So if language is simplified, how are you able to deal with complex things, complex expressions, complex ideas? And that's becoming very, very, very apparent as generations pass, that they're unable to deal with these kinds of things.
I think language is also important for empathy. I mean, yes. that's what's really lacking in this world right now.
Well, I have a question. I've been in my mind for a long time, right? So let's say, just take the word, say, let's say melancholia, all right? If you don't know the word melancholia, can you...
Does the sound hint
can
meaning?
Can you feel melancholia?
Now, melancholia is a very, very interesting word. There was a great book called The Anatomy of Melancholy, written by Richard Burton. It's a huge, thick book sometime in the 16th century, 17th century, I don't know. But today we regard melancholia as depression. And then we pill pop. And we don't allow the wonders of melancholy to basically take you over and write wonderful poems. So you see, it's just gotten so clinical.
But if you don't know the word, are you able to express...
No, well, I think you can experience it if you don't know the word, but you might not be able to express how you feel.
Yeah, but the problem is this. It's not that you don't know the word. You just have another word for it.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, so you you don't regard it as... They don't even use sad these days. They use depressed. Everything, I'm depressed. Mm. And then they create, you know, chat groups with entire depression communities, and then they video themselves killing each other.
Yeah. Oh, what?
Killing themselves in front of each other.
All right, okay. Well, I can't even. So, so Eddie, we're going to move on. But finally, so if you were to teach language, what would your language course be?
I mean, how I don't long know.
Would it be? You take a child at the age of 5 and they don't graduate till they're 35 or something.
You know, I still believe in Rousseau's idea of how you educate a child. Don't send him to school. Just dump him into a room full of books. And then he has nothing better to do. So he will read them and get highly sophisticated.
Oh, okay. So, you will start up the Edinco School and...
What language will he be reading those books in?
Hopefully in about at least 10 different languages.
10 different languages.
Yeah. John Stuart Mills, I think, he and his father used to walk around the garden.
Yeah.
And the father and he would make up a language. And they would give words to different objects. And then he said before he knew it, he'd been taught how to speak ancient Greek.
Yeah. Well, the only learned person... as Camus always reminds us, is the autodidact. So you can be given foundational education. Yeah. After that, you educate yourself.
Anyway, let's move on. To the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. And I guess I go first, don't I? So my recommendation is, I recently went on holiday to the Philippines. And it was beautiful, and beaches and all that kind of thing.
Incredible country.
Yeah. But one thing I'd always wanted to do, and I'd never done, was... go on holiday and read a book. It's one of those things that you always kind of like, you know, hear about that or see in the movies that people just go and read a book. But I'd never done it. So I did. And it was a fantastic book that I happened to take. And it taught me a lot about the world, about economics and the way that economies function. It's written by a guy called George Crowley. And it's called City of Fortune. It's about the subtitle, The Rise and Fall of the Venetian Empire. So there I was in Philippines reading about the Venetian Empire and how it mentions almost in passing how this part of the world was crucially important to the growth of Venice. And Venice became the most richest spot of land in the world because it was in the trade of taking spices, amongst other things, but spices from here and taking
here being Southeast Asia.
Yeah. But through hundreds of middlemen, especially when it got to the Arabian Peninsula and Egypt, then it'd be passing through many hands, and the price would go up and up and up. And how the Venetian Empire collapsed really quite suddenly as soon as the first Portuguese ship came here on its own. And that Portuguese ship could fill itself up with pepper, take it back, and sell the pepper at like half the price, and yet also make a 5,000% profit. And then the Venetian Empire collapsed within 20 years. But it's a wonderful book, and I really loved it. I just want to recommend it. George Crowley, City of Fortune, The Rise and Fall of the Venetian Empire. Great book to read if you're ever going to be
On holiday.
On a beach in the Philippines. So, Farah, what's your...
I would like to recommend this new movie called, what's it called? Dendam Pontiana by my friend Gavin Yap and Glenn Goy. It stars Fazura and Remy Isha. It's really... I think the director did a really good job in turning the genre, this horror genre, on its head.
They directed it together?
Yeah.
Glenn Goy of Singapore. Of Singapore.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They opened in Singapore, I think, a week ago or a couple of weeks ago, and it was the highest grossing Malay film in Singapore for a while.
And it's a Malaysian-Singapore co-production.
Yeah.
Hands across the causeway.
It looks really good. It's well acted. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. And Edin?
My recommendation is the Kama Sutra and the chapter on the prelude to love. Which talks a great deal about how important speech and conversation in the act of love is. In other words, a very nice description of what you call sweet nothings. So I'd go to that chapter. That's my recommendation. And I have a second one.
Okay, go ahead.
My second recommendation is something I learned in school by a school teacher who taught around the 1920s. And he taught diction, English language, with a particular emphasis on diction. He gave himself a pen name, Carivarius. Latin, I think.
Don't ask me.
So, you know, I go back to talking about speech and talking about the purpose of language to reading something like this. Dearest creature in creation, study English pronunciation. I will teach you in my verse sounds like corpse, core, horse, and worse. I will keep you, Susie, busy, make your head with heat grow dizzy. And it goes on and on and on and on for about 100 lines. So my recommendation is to do that and read that every single day.
Yeah, and read it out loud.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wordplay.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, that neatly brings us to the end. But before we go, Farah, are you in any shows or anything anytime
Thank you.
Soon?
Thank you so much for that, Cam. I'm actually doing improv at Manara Ken Saturday the 14th, I believe. With Dato Avlid Chowki and Sharifa Amani. My improv troupe is called Aya, so please come join us.
So no script, no...
No just, script, nothing.
Just make it up.
Just make it up as we go along.
And you just sort of scream in terror for half an hour.
Yes. Drink fest would be funnier.
Okay, great. So, that brings us to the end of this week's show. And only remains me now to thank Farah Rani. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cam.
And Edin Kuhu.
Thank you.
Great to have you both back. And myself, Cam Rustland, and please join us next time on another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.